gentlemen around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Solo of Servano show on WWDB Talk 860 here in Philadelphia. We've got a great show planned for everyone today. Our host is John Servanos. John, how are you, sir?
Great, Joe. Thank you.
We've got a great show. We've got a great guest on the program. We have Congresswoman Susan Wild, the Democrat serving Pennsylvania's 7th District in the Lehigh Valley. Congresswoman, how are you?
I am fine. Thanks so much for asking. Doing just fine today.
Well, it's great to have you on the broadcast. A little background. The Congresswoman is a history maker. She became the first woman to be appointed Allentown City Solicitor. And in November 2018, she made history when she was elected as the first woman to represent Pennsylvania's 7th Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives. Congresswoman, you know, we have so much to talk about, but we want to kind of start off talking, about some of the things that are important to you, and that, you know, you have, in many senses, made a major difference in. One of the things that is, I think, incredibly impressive is your commitment to legislating in a bipartisan manner. Talk about that, because in America, one of the issues we have is the competence in Washington, D.C. And one of those problems is that, you know, people don't feel like, you know, they're, you know, making a difference. They think it's everything goes down party lines. Talk about your commitment there.
Well, thanks for the question. And I will say to you that there's a reason that we don't see that much bipartisanship anymore. And that's because with gerrymandering, we've gotten rid of so many competitive districts that people from either party who are in these safe seats don't have any good reason to compromise because their constituents aren't demanding it of them. Now, by contrast, I am in a district that is almost evenly split between Democrats and Republicans and has a very large percentage of independents. So first of all, it comes to me naturally in my past life. And I had cases with John Servanos in the past, and compromise is part of being a litigator, and so I'm used to it. But it's also, I think, very, very important for the political system. We can't be dictators here. We can't demand that we always get our own way. We have to be willing to give an inch here and there so that we can accomplish the greater good. And it's just, we're not seeing enough of it, but it's really important to me. It's really important to my constituents.
And I find it, you know, so over 60% of the votes that you've cast during your time in Congress have been bipartisan votes. What I think about is that's awesome, because I think confidence in the American people in a lot of ways depends on that. People want to know that, you know, that their representatives are voting on the issues that are and that they're really passionate about on the issues, in particular. And one of the issues I've always felt is that people don't feel, and I mean the general public, you know, where they lose confidence is the fact that they don't feel like they're being represented. They feel like it's a party line. It's so awesome to see that you're, I think you're ranked among the top 30% of bipartisan members in either party.
Right.
Let's also talk about, you know, some of your legislative priorities.
Sure.
Before we move on to that, John, do you want to jump in there for a second?
I was going to wait for you to be finished with your questions. I got a onslaught for the Congresswoman.
Okay, so
there's a lot of my own opinions, which I'll try to refrain from giving.
Well, having said that, though, I want to get into the legislative priorities of the Congresswoman. And you talk about lowering prescription drug prices and expanding Medicare. Touch on that, if you will.
Sure, happy to. Reducing prescription drug prices, by the way, should be something that is the most bipartisan of issues. There is literally, there's nobody that doesn't think that prescription drug prices are too high. And I hear about it constantly in my district, and it boggles my mind that we can't get consensus, but it shouldn't really boggle my mind because I know how things work. And I know that the pharmaceutical lobby has two lobbyists for every member of Congress, which is appalling. It's one of the reasons that I pledged before I ever started running for Congress that I would never take pharmaceutical money because I don't want them calling me and telling me to vote in certain ways. Not that, and I'm not suggesting that everybody that takes money from specific lobby, specific PACs is beholden to them. There are many, many independent thinkers in Congress, but it sure makes it a whole lot more difficult. So it's a winning issue. It is something that constituents on both sides of the aisle feel very strongly about. And I'm very, very proud that we recently passed the bill through the House to restrict the price of insulin to $35 a month. But the problem is, number one, hasn't passed the Senate yet, which, of course, is always a challenge. And number two is that that's great if you're somebody who needs insulin. But what if you're somebody with cancer who needs a really expensive cancer drug or somebody with asthma who needs inhalers that are ridiculously expensive? So we really need to do more on prescription drug pricing. And the way that happens is by allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices, just as Medicaid and the Veterans Administration can do, two other large federal programs that are able to negotiate drug prices. And yet inexplicably, in its infinite wisdom, many years ago, Congress made it illegal for Medicare to negotiate drug prices. And that has the effect of keeping them artificially high. Americans are literally subsidizing the rest of the world when it comes to prescription drug prices. And that's why people go to Canada and elsewhere and buy their drugs, because they're so much cheaper in other countries. So enough said about that. And then you asked me about Medicare expansion, I think. Is that the second part of it? Yeah. And so Medicare expansion, quite honestly, is something that is similarly popular, although, you know, there are different approaches to it. Some members of Congress believe that the age of the qualifying age for Medicare should be lowered. I'm in agreement that it should be lowered. I don't believe that it should be lowered as much as some of my colleagues do. There have been proposals to have it be age 60 or even 55. I'd like to see it lowered to 62. And I'll tell you why. What we see is a lot of people who are in that 60 to 65 age range who really need to retire, but can't. And the reason they can't is because they're dependent on their employer provided health coverage. People who are working in very physically demanding jobs, whether it's construction, warehouse work, or whatever, you know, your body starts to give out, and it's really tough. And so it's a shame to see that. You also see a lot of situations with married couples, especially traditional married couples, where the husband's been working for years and the wife hasn't been, and she's either not working or is working part-time and doesn't have employer-provided health insurance. If he's a couple years older than she is, you will see a situation where he continues to work beyond the age that he'd like to retire at, because he's got to make sure that he keeps his employer provided coverage for his wife, who might be a year or two younger than he is. And I know of a number of people who fit that category. So anyway, those are just some of the ideas that I have and that we've been trying to advance.
Your commitment to supporting labor and education. Talk about that.
Well, I am in a district that has some of the wealthiest school districts in the state and has a couple of the absolute poorest in the state. And they are right next to each other. And it's heart-wrenching to see. I've been in the schools in both kinds of school districts. And when you consider that what we are trying to do with public school education is to educate our young for the future of this, for their future and for the future of this country, it's appalling to see the disparity between them and how, you know, how they're taught, the quality of their schools, the resources that they have, the books that they have and everything else. And I have my own children were born here in Allentown. They were raised here and they went to public schools their entire lives, and had the good fortune to be in one of the school districts with a lot of resources, and it made a huge difference. They were well prepared for their education beyond high school. But we're just not giving young people in some of our public school districts the advantages that they need to really get ahead. And I'm also very, very committed to the cause of higher education. And I'm not just talking about colleges, although I definitely feel like a college education is an important thing for people who are inclined that way and want to go to college. But here, and by the way, we have 6 colleges and universities here in the Lehigh Valley, including 2 community colleges that are absolutely stellar examples of higher education and provide great opportunities to first generation college students in particular. But there's, you know, the often ignored part of higher education is the technical and vocational and trade training, which we need so desperately in this country. I mean, my district is full of manufacturers doing really awesome things, not like old school manufacturing, like we think about it from the 40s and 50s, where you often worked in a dirty factory with a lot of hazardous substances around and that kind of thing. These are gleaming, beautiful, highly technological factories that literally just need more workers. And so many people, I think, really get left behind by this concept that we had for so long in this country that everybody needs to have a college education. It's just not so. But the fact of the matter is, we do know that every year of higher education that you have beyond high school will vastly improve your station in life overall. It's just that we got to get out of this rut of thinking that that only applies to college.
Yeah, and it's interesting because as part of the labor movement here in Philadelphia, our apprenticeships are such a big deal. You know, like you mentioned, not everybody is acclimated, you know, to go to college. It's not, you know, some people are artistically inclined, and other, you know, other individuals are like you said, they may be they may be good with their hands. They may be inclined to become a member of the building trades. And that we try to do here, what I think a lot of, you know, union communities are doing. And that is, we have a lot of our unions, you know, that outreach into the communities, you know, apprentice program, training classes, so that if somebody wants to take a, you know, to take a, you know, a class so that they get the opportunity to actually, you know, pick the test for a union, that they can actually pass that test, because a lot of the trades are skilled trades, and, you know, math and English, and, you know, and some science are you know, part of the test. Talk about that in a sense. Partnership with either labor or, you know, technical schools and the training, and giving kids that opportunity at the exposure who may not be aware of it.
Well, I will say that up here in the Lehigh Valley and actually throughout Pennsylvania, I have to say, we have seen some amazing examples of how well apprenticeships can work. Yesterday, I had a manufacturer's roundtable, and there were a number of the manufacturers there who actually have devised their own apprenticeship programs and have talked to me about how well they work. They literally recruit kids straight out of high school, or in some cases out of community college, bring them over. And then not only are they, they're essentially paying young people to learn, it's, you know, earn while you earn, or earn while you learn. and not incur a whole lot of student loan debt. But they're also in that at the same time, it's to the benefit of the employers because they are able to teach that employee or that apprentice exactly the skills that they want in that specific business. And so, you know, it's just a great mutual opportunity and it works really well. Organized labor has always been ahead of us, of the business community in general, in terms of the apprenticeships, construction trades and electricians and so forth have really phenomenal, pipe fitters have really phenomenal apprenticeship programs. And I'm just going to stress, it gives a lot of people the opportunity to learn a really marketable skill that will put them in a great paying job, but without incurring all this crazy student loan debt that we hear so much about. So it's really a win-win.
Yeah. And when you talk, that's a great point. When one of the things that we profess with our labor show that we do here in Philadelphia, obviously the apprenticeships are such a big deal. But the beautiful thing about it is not only is the individual who gets the opportunity to apprentice getting a free education, they're actually, it's an education that is not subsidized by the government. It's paid for by the union itself, and they're working while they're on the job training, and so the opportunity to make money is while you're being trained is something that we feel it's incredibly important. Having said that, what I'd like to do, we're going to touch base on a couple more issues, and then we're going to get into a lot of the topics that John has created for our interview. You have a commitment, obviously, to our military. You grew up in a military family. Talk about that commitment right now in a world that's so uncertain. In making our military, as strong as it needs to be, and obviously supporting our troops.
So you are absolutely right. I grew up in a military family. I was an Air Force brat. My dad was a lifer in the Air Force. We moved all over the place with him as a result. I saw firsthand, I went to school with other military kids, and, I have the most amazing respect for our service members and our veterans. The second week of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, I traveled to Poland with some other members of Congress, met with the 82nd Airborne, as well as their comrades from the British forces, the French forces, Canadian, and so forth. It's just amazing when you look at these people who are sent all over the world to defend democracy. Large part of it is defending our country, but it's also in pursuit of the defense of democracy worldwide. In December of 2019, just before the COVID shutdowns, I was privileged enough to travel to the Middle East over Christmas break to visit with our troops in the Middle East, in Bahrain and a couple of other places. And, they're making a real sacrifice. And by the way, that trip over Christmas of 2019, 2 days after I got back, was when the strike on General Soleimani, the Iranian general, occurred. And if you recall, there was tremendous concern that there was going to be immediate retaliation. Our Mideast troops were deployed to parts unknown. And I couldn't help, here I was 2 days after my trip, having just met a bunch of these young soldiers and wondering where in the world they had been sent and how they were going to fare. So, it's truly, that nobody who serves in elected office, certainly not at the federal level, should go longer than a year or two without having the both the privilege and the obligation to visit our troops who are stationed at some other place in the world, because we owe so much to them.
And growing up in a military family and traveling all over the world, how does that impact your position as a legislator, you know, understanding and being, and seeing up close and personal, what it's like to put, have a loved one in harm's way.
Yeah. Well, so my dad served in World War II and Korea. His two brothers both served. I lost an uncle in Vietnam. My family has all, and beyond that, I've had many cousins who have served and so forth. And so, as I said before, I have a real healthy respect for those who serve. Having said that, it influences me very much in many ways. First of all, I'm on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. I grew up in a household that was pretty tuned in to what was happening around the world and talked about it regularly at the dinner table. By the way, my father was a Republican. My mom was a Democrat. So, I grew up at a time when you could actually have married couples who coexisted and weren't from the political party, which is certainly a challenge these days, I think. But having said that, they both made me very, very aware that we may be the greatest country in the world. We certainly view ourselves that way, but we are very much part of a global community. And and since my childhood growing up in that way, I've really come to understand a lot of things. Some of it, by the way, from people in my district or from the manufacturers. Well, let me just start with the people in my district. Although people often don't know it about the Lehigh Valley, number one, it's the third largest region in Pennsylvania after Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and is often off, not on people's radar if they're from outside the state and they're thinking about Pennsylvania. But it's also an increasingly diverse district. It has a number of communities that are made up of people who have come to this state from elsewhere, but largely in response to the growth in our manufacturing sector and in the growth in our healthcare sector. We have two large hospital networks up here that have really attracted a number of very diverse communities. And I bring that up because I am regularly engaged with people who have family relationships around the world, whether it's the Muslim community, and they're speaking to me about their concerns about the Uyghur Muslims in China or the Kashmiris, people in the Indian community who had, were struggling so much with family members back in India during COVID and when India just had so many difficulties, or people right now, I have in this district a very large community of Ukrainians, and I don't have to tell you what their concerns are. And I've been engaged with that community, the Ukrainian community, literally since my first week in Congress. But of course, over the last number of weeks, have been much more involved with them and actively working with them. And so it's just really important to always remember that we are Americans, but this country is made up of large groups of people with connections around the world, citizens of the United States with connections around the world. We can't forget that.
And I'm going to bring John into the program because you said something, a lot of, really important stuff there, but in a sense, it all, blends into being educated on the issues and understanding them and having grown up at the dinner table talking about those issues and understanding the issues. Obviously we have a diverse country. We hail in Philadelphia, a very diverse area, a lot of concerns around the world. Talking about educating individuals and voting and getting involved in the process. And as part of organized labor, that's one of the things we try to really push. We do because, when you're voting for specific offices, president would be one of them. You should know what you're voting for. Supreme Court. You should know the issues and understand them. And then, you know, we always say, and I do, you know, we have issues like right to work and all that stuff. And if you're voting against your party, you're voting, you know, against your economic ability and your economic situation. So having said that, John, I'm going to bring John and John Zervanos into the program. And John, there's a lot of issues going on that you put together that, you know, are incredibly important and that we want to educate people on, you know, such as the swing district, the gerrymandering, which the congresswoman brought up. If you will, first of all, welcome to the broadcast and please jump in.
I just I can follow what Susan said, that when I have an office in the Lehigh Valley, one of the it's how I met Congressman Wild, and I can speak from experience. I just lost my video, I think.
Okay, that's all right.
Yeah, I can speak from experience that there's a very large Syrian community in Lehigh Valley. Isn't that correct,
Susan? Yes, there is.
And when I first started practicing up there, I met one of the local leaders of the community and started representing folks in that community. And you know, they're very, very committed to each other, making sure that, you know, they look out for each other. And before I knew it, I had the largest group of folks that I was representing in the Lehigh Valley seemed to come from either the Syrian community or the Lebanese community. And I was very, very surprised that there was this enclave of folks from the Middle East. And then I learned through my connections with them that I guess the largest group of Islamic community or Middle Eastern community is in Michigan, or right outside of Detroit. So there was this interaction between the Syrians and Lebanese in the Lehigh Valley and those in Michigan. And, you know, it's just, you brought up an interesting point about the diversity of this country and how important it is. And that I think what's happened is, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I remember, and that was in the late 60s and 70s, you know, you heard about, you know, the racial divide and the cultural divides, which we kind of have again, unfortunately. But what I've come to appreciate probably more than anything is I think there's this rural versus urban fight in this country. And I don't want to get into this just yet, but I you know, you see what's happening in Oklahoma and Texas and Missouri, where, you know, the cultural wars that are just setting in Florida. God only knows what's going on down there, where, you know, DeSantis is taking on Disney now. But you know, with women's rights are being eviscerated, and it seems to be in red states. And my concern is that we have this divide that's developing between urban America and rural America, where rural America doesn't trust urban America and vice versa. I don't know if the congresswoman has anything to say about that. And I know I'm walking a fine line because she's in a very purple district. But I'd be interested in hearing what she might have to say about that.
So, you know, I'll say, John, this, my district absolutely is composed of both rural and urban areas, although we're not urban like Philadelphia is, but we certainly have more city-fied portions. And the one thing that is consistent across my district, because we're not a super rich district. We don't have a lot of hedge fund. I'm not sure we have any hedge fund billionaires or anything like that. But the one thing that's consistent across my district is that people are really, really concerned about kitchen table issues. They are concerned about the price of gas. They're concerned about the cost of medical care, their prescription drugs, as I mentioned before. They want to make sure their children are well cared for when they're not at home. They want to make sure that they can get a good education for their kids and that they themselves can have good jobs and hopefully enough money to, you know, go vacation at the shore once in a while. So, you know, that's what I have found in my district. I have colleagues in Congress who represent considerably more rural areas than I do. And, you know, so I can't speak to every aspect of rural America, but I will tell you, I mean, just last week, the undersecretary of the Department of Agriculture came to see us to go visit one of the small farms in our district about a value added grant that they were awarded. And, you know, the issues that apply to farmers everywhere apply here too. Weather conditions, you know, the devastation that they see from droughts or floods. So, you know, those same conditions, weather and other kinds of disasters affect our urban areas also, but in a different kind of way. So I don't see a whole lot of, I don't see a whole lot of light between the issues that exist in the rural parts of my district and the urban parts. I think it's more accentuated when you're looking at the country as a whole, where you definitely do have, you know, more of a distinction.
Right. Well, you know, since we're focusing in on the rural and the urban, and particularly your district, how is your race going so far? I understand. Isn't your race against the same person you went up against the last time?
Well, it probably will be. May 17th is the primary, and there is a Republican primary. So my opponent from last time, a woman who is a self-funder, meaning she's got the resources to completely fund her race from beginning to end and spend the millions on it that it takes to run one of these races, which is another whole topic that we should talk about on another day, the crazy cost of running a campaign. But she does have a primary opponent and they will face off on May 17th. I do not have a primary, which I hope and think is a reflection that people feel like I've done a good job and they don't want to challenge me, at least not from within my own party. So I'm very much right now I'm focused on the work that I've been doing on the official side, meaning as opposed to the campaign side. And there is a distinction and a lot of people don't quite realize it, but for ethical reasons, there's no crossover between the two because quite frankly, taxpayers are paying for the work that you do on the official side. They are not paying for the work you do on the campaign side. So you have to keep them separate. Right now, I am very focused on the official side of things. I've been home for 2 weeks. And by the way, Congress doesn't go on recess, at least not for people in districts like mine. We go back to our respective districts to work in the district, not to go, you know, sleep late and have a vacation. Anyway, just had to get that off my chest because people seem to think that when Congress is not in Washington, that we're not working, which is nothing could be further from the truth. But the last couple of weeks, I have been visiting with manufacturers, I've been visiting with farmers, and I had a town hall last night. I've been talking to individual constituents about their concerns. I hear from people, you know, all the time. We are very, very responsive to our constituents who request time with me, either by phone or in person, and we do a lot of that. So, you know, that's mostly what I'm focused on. And I believe the way I win this race in November is by, you know, by overperforming on the official side.
Well, it seems like you've been doing that for 4 years.
Yeah. Right. Trying really hard.
Yes, you are. I find it. I ran into one of our mutual friends who we were talking about. Your race came up, in particular, we talked about it, how unfortunate it is for Congress people that they win an election and they have to get ready for the next one because you're only on for 2 years.
It's insane. It is really insane. And it's a shame we can't do something about it. Because quite honestly, I find it very frustrating. This year has not been quite as bad as it has been in other years. But you know, we're elected for 2-year terms. You come in January for the new term. That first year is all about legislation and policy and working on things. And then by year two, everybody starts focusing on the fact that it's an election year. Not only does that mean that people have to start spending a lot of time on their campaigns, but it also means that people start to become less willing to work with the other side. Because God forbid you should hand the other side a win, quote unquote. So this prescription drug pricing that we've been talking about, you know, I really believe that most Republicans in Congress think that we need to do something about prescription drug pricing. But if we do something now and it actually gets through, the concern is, well, it looks like Democrats had a win and they don't want that to happen in an election year. And so it's really very destructive, I think, to good government practices to have this. But the other part of it, quite honestly, is just the insane cost of political campaigns these days. When I think of all the good that could be done in this world and in this country if we spent less money on political campaigns and more money on things that we want to change, very frustrating.
Let me jump in and give a little ID to the program and the station. I want our listeners to know that they're listening to the Solo Gravano Show on WWDB Talk 860 with our host, John Zervanos. I'm your co-host, Joe Dougherty. John's guest is Congresswoman Susan Wild, serving Pennsylvania's 7th District in the Lehigh Valley. Great conversation. You know, you make some fantastic points there, especially in regards to dealing with the politics of getting things passed and a lot of the blocking of issues and understanding that obviously the prescription drug price issue is such an important issue, and I know it's such a priority. Talk about, if you would, you mentioned that you were part of a town hall last night. What were the primary issues that were brought up by your constituents?
So I do town halls pretty regularly. Sometimes I do them in a focused kind of way, like with a group of manufacturers or employers, and other times they're just open to the public generally. Lately, the questions I've been hearing about the most are the supply chain issues, shortages. Whoever would have thought a year ago that supply chain would be part of our everyday, parlance, but it is now, even for people who aren't in manufacturing. Obviously, hearing a fair amount about inflation, and I completely commiserate with my constituents and Americans everywhere with the pricing. As I often tell people, I drive back and forth to Washington every week. I pump my own gas. I know exactly how much it costs at the pump. When I get back to Pennsylvania, every time I do, the first stop I make is at a grocery store because my refrigerator will be bare after a week in Washington. And I've experienced the same sticker shock that everybody else has. And so it's, obviously I can relate to those concerns and I'm very concerned about them. You know, the truth of the matter is Congress doesn't have a whole lot of control over things like inflation and gas prices. But what we do have control over is bringing down the cost of specific things that will help Americans while we are going through inflation. So, if we can bring down the cost of childcare, if we can help people with the price of their prescription drugs, things like that, it helps overall. So lately, I hear a lot about that. In the past, lots of questions about education, both public sector and higher education. I also get a fair number of questions about the environment, more so than you might expect at a time when it seems like we've all been focused on COVID and wars abroad and those kinds of things. The environment, and maybe it's the nature of this district, the environment has always been a bipartisan issue here. And, you know, then in the past, not as, I mean, obviously during COVID, lots and lots and lots of questions about COVID and COVID restrictions and government programs to help people struggling with, you know, the loss of a small business and or the closure of a small business and that kind of thing. So it's all over the place. You know, the topics for our town halls tend to go with the flow of what's happening in the country at any given time.
John Zervanos.
Yeah, I'd like to dovetail. It's funny you say that the Congress can't control certain prices, and I get in these conversations sometimes, and usually it's with family members, because most lawyers like myself think on the same side of the spectrum. But I always find it interesting that, you know, it's Biden's fault. It's, you know, when Trump was in the White House, it was whatever was going on there. It was Trump's fault. And, you know, wherever you are, if you're Republican or Democrat, you tend to believe what you want to believe. Thus, the reason why people tune into stations and media outlets that will support what their beliefs are. But I had a conversation over the weekend, and, you know, the guy that I was talking to was saying, yeah, you know, Biden this, Biden that. And I said to him, I said, he's not the king. And what I find fascinating, I said, he can't wave a magic wand and suddenly say, guess what? We are now not going to let gas prices go above $4 a gallon. That's authoritarianism. That's what Putin can do in Russia. And what I find interesting is people look at me like, I'm talking, you know, I'm Greek, so I shouldn't say I'm talking Greek, but you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's like they look at you cross-eyed, like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, our government, you know, it's divided, you know, you got your judiciary, you got your legislative, you got your executive branch, they're all supposed to work together. It's not one person has the ability to control prices. And I find that fascinating that so many people just don't understand. And the reason why I'm saying this is when you have these town halls, do you find that you spend a lot of your time trying to educate your audience on how government works to help them understand the issues?
I do try to, but, you know, it's also some parts of it could be like watching paint dry. You know, I mean, does anybody really want to hear about how a reconciliation bill passes Congress? So you got to walk a line there. I do like to help people understand how it works. And I find some people are fascinated by it, and I will try to elaborate. And then there are other things that people really just, you know, and quite honestly, one of the things that I think we have not done particularly well over the past year is the process of legislating has become almost too painfully apparent to the American public. So I'm talking in particular about the Build Back Better Act, where the, you know, if you cared to listen, you could be treated to the rather uninteresting stories of exactly where the Build Back Better Act stood on at any given hour on any given day. Right. And trust me, the American public, for the most part, you know, just doesn't even want to hear about it. They want to hear the results. They want the results.
That's why I think there's some attraction to these shock politicians, if you will, and these are your colleagues, so obviously you don't have to comment, but on both sides, you know, you got Marjorie Taylor Greene, but then, you know, Ortega, but she's in the Bronx, and they get away with being able to be extreme because they can get away with it. And I don't want to get into that, but one thing I want to ask you, and I know I can't believe the time's already, we're almost out of time, but, you know, you hear on the from the media that, you know, the 2022 political climate, you know, the Democrats are in for a real hurt. And what's going to happen if the GOP takes over? You know, you hear Mitch McConnell saying, you know, if a Supreme Court nominee is chosen by Biden, they're not even going to get a vote. And mm-hmm. and I'm very concerned about this extreme partisanship. Do you hear anything in when you're in Washington, you know, between Republicans or Democrats, where it's like, oh, you just wait until we get the House back, we're going to show you. I mean, do you hear any of that stuff?
I hear both. I hear, and I hate to say it. Again, it comes back to the people in the few competitive districts that are left, like mine, mm-hmm. are the ones who really, really want to work with folks on the other side of the aisle. And part of it is because you need to politically, but part of it is because we are that way that we got elected to begin with in our districts. It's not just because, you know, the people in our districts expect us to. So, and it's just, that's why I think it's so unfortunate that this extreme gerrymandering has occurred everywhere in the United States, because I fear that we are headed for greater division rather than fixing that.
Yeah, but that's what I don't understand. It paralyzes legislation. You can't get anything done. And does it, don't the state legislators who are creating this crazy gerrymandering realize that in doing that, you lose your competitive districts, and therefore nothing's going to get done, and everybody's entrenched either end.
I'll tell you why they don't see it that way. That's why it's that the parties have taken sort of this all or nothing approach. So, you know, the GOP wants to control the White House. They want to control the House, and they want to control the Senate, because then they will just do it their way. And to be candid, the Democratic Party feels the same way about it. So, you know, I don't mean to sound like a total pessimist, because I do hope that we are going to eventually come around to going back to doing things the old way, where people literally negotiated and compromised on things. But the only way you can deal with extreme gerrymandering is to try to take everything, winner take all. And then you don't have to worry about negotiating with the other side, because you control it all. So
yeah, that's great for the winning side, but
it's great for the winning side. And you know what's going to happen? As long as we have this, it's going to keep going. It's just going to be cyclical, because what's going to happen is, if, you know, let's just say the GOP takes everything in November, of course they won't have the White House, but you know, and then they just say, well, we're going to burn the place down and do everything our own way. Well, there will be a wave effect, less so because the districts have been so gerrymandered, but it will catch up.
Well, that leads me to this question. And that is, okay, the House is going to swing back and forth because he's gerrymandering. But I honestly believe this. And I look at a state like Pennsylvania, and I saw when Obama was in the White House, how Pennsylvania really wasn't even that competitive from a statewide view. And that is, if Philly and Pittsburgh and the urban folks get their vote out, I don't see how the Republicans stand a chance, because the population centers are so blue that if you do the math, how is it possible? That's assuming you get the vote out, but how is it possible? And that's going to add, I mean, leading to my question to you about the Senate here in this state, but how is it possible for a Republican to win a statewide election? I mean, you saw it with Wolf. I mean, a statewide election, you can beat back the GOP if Pittsburgh and Philadelphia runs the show.
That's a big if, though. We got to get the vote out.
Exactly. Philadelphia's got to get its vote out, and the collared counties. And it's so blue here. It's so blue here that, you know, you go from Philly, and I practice all over the state. You get into that swath between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh. They make that old joke about Pennsylvania. It's another universe. It's another universe. And my question to you, Congresswoman, is do you believe, and you don't have to say, yeah, I believe you, I think that's what would happen if Philly and the collar county gets their vote out all the time. But take this Senate race in Pennsylvania, because I'm concerned. Maybe the House goes to the GOP, but I look at the Senate. It's basically 50-50. And there's states like PA, you know, Toomey is how his seat is up. You got other states, you know, don't you see the Pennsylvania race as a Democrat race to lose?
You know, I never adopt that way of thinking, John, because I feel like that's dangerous. I think it presses turnout when you think that way. I don't see it that way. I think it's going to be a very competitive year in that U.S. Senate race. I think the governor's race, where, listen, I am the world's biggest fan of Josh Shapiro, and I'm thrilled that he doesn't have a primary and that he's our nominee. I think even the governor's race is going to be highly competitive. We're just that kind of state. And remember, it used to be that there wasn't a lot of turnout in some of the midsection of our state. And so you could really influence it by turning out the vote in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And not to belabor the point, but turnout is always a problem. And Democrats really need to get their act together and make sure that we have the kind of turnout we've had in our best presidential years. But I still believe that Pennsylvania is a swing state. And, you know, I mentioned before, just to put in another plug for the Lehigh Valley, we are the third largest region in Pennsylvania. This is a deeply purple district. This district can literally decide that U.S. Senate race. It can decide the governor's race.
Yeah.
I
think you're right. I absolutely agree with you. And I'm very concerned about the governor's race. And it kind of like I touched on this in when I spoke to you about what topics I wanted to discuss. You know, my concern is, and I know we're running out of time, and I wanted to talk about the courts. I mean, real quickly, because obviously it's important to lawyers, but it's obviously important to the public, even though sometimes they don't appreciate how important it is. You need to, you know, having a Democratic governor, even though the GOP is always going to control the legislature here, kind of balances the ability of what direction the courts are going, even though we have elected judges here. Are you concerned? I mean, you see what's happening with the Supreme Court and the politicalization of these courts. And, you know, I kind of go back and forth over whether or not we should elect our judges. And, you know, after you see what.
That's funny. I do too, John. I can't decide whether I think, I actually, before I came to Pennsylvania, I practiced for law in Maryland for 6 years, where they appoint judges, and there were a lot of problems with that too.
I think so. I agree with you, and I don't know what.
About 2.5 minutes.
What's that?
You got about 2.5-3 minutes.
Right. Well, I just my concern is you know the fiasco that we just watched with the political points that are trying to be made during the confirmation hearing. I don't know what the answer is. And I'm just hoping that the courts stay near and dear to what they're supposed to, and that's to be neutral. And what's happening in the other parts of this country with regard to, you know, the rights that women are losing is scary. It really is.
Women and people all over this country. And when I say people, I'm talking about people in the LGBT community. And I'm also talking about people whose voting rights are being seriously trampled on.
Yeah,
absolutely. So what I'd like to do, we got about a minute left. Congresswoman, if you'd want to take about 45 seconds and have parting words, that would be fantastic.
I thank you so much, first of all, for having me on this. I could spend all day talking to John Zervanos about these issues. And look, I want to see everybody get incredibly engaged in this year's election. I deeply want to win re-election here in the Greater Lehigh Valley. It'll be my third term in Congress, and I got a lot of work left to be done to build on the work that I've already done. If anybody wants to know more about me, my website is wildforcongress.com. Pretty easy. And, you know, just please, please, please understand that politics and government really does make a difference in your life.
Fantastic. John, 30 seconds.
Real quick. I knew the Congresswoman. She was a lawyer. She was someone who was always willing to work with us and never drew a line in the sand. And, you know, she talked about compromising. She's as good as it gets in listening to the other side. And she'll be a value to Lehigh Valley for a long time if they keep her.
Thanks so much, John.
All right. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Soul of Zervanos show and our host, John Zervanos. We want to thank Congresswoman Susan Wild for being a fantastic guest. And, of course, we want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Soul of Zervanos show on WWDB Talk 860. On behalf of John Zervanos and Congresswoman Susan Wild, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening.
Soloff and Zervanos has your back. If you or someone you know is the victim of physical or sexual abuse or assault as the result of the negligence of a third-party organization or individuals, please understand that you are not alone and justice could be but one comforting and confidential phone call away. Please contact the law firm of Soloff and Zervanos at 215-608-4067 or visit their website at soloffandzervanos.com. If you or someone you know has been the victim of physical or sexual abuse or assault as a result of the negligence of a third-party organization or individuals, and let their comforting and understanding attorneys seek the justice you deserve. Again, contact the law firm of Soloff and Zervanos at 215-608-4067 or go to soloffandzervanos.com and let them seek the justice you deserve. Soloff and Zervanos also represents individuals injured as the result of auto accidents, medical malpractice, construction accidents, defective products, slip and falls, and victims of crime. At Soloff and Zervanos, they have your back.